Good day, everybody who's listening. It's Friday the 13th of November. I hope that doesn't portend anything bad for this little thing I'm doing here, which is a conversation with somebody called Toby Baxendale. Now, he's an interesting man because he's an entrepreneur, quite a successful one, as I've just been finding out, looking around his fish distribution enterprise. A little bit of it. It's a big thing. It stretches all over the country and has connections all over the world. But he's also a free market intellectual who is part of the team that set up the Cobden Centre. Now, either of those two things would be interesting in themselves. The two together makes him a man I really am glad to be talking to. So thanks for doing this, Toby. And could you start by telling us a little bit about what sort of start in life you had?
Well, the start in life was, I suppose, first memories, Acton, West London. Single parent family housing association with my mother and my sister. And mother, in fairness to her, was not your stereotypical single parent mother. She realized that if she got herself a degree and could start teaching, she could run us to the same timetable as her job, post nursery school, which so during our nursery upbringing, she was doing her degree and working in a nightclub, working in a wine bar and doing part-time teaching at night school. And then when she became a fully qualified teacher, she taught at Chiswick Comprehensive, and we went to school at the same time as she went to work. So that's how we got around that. And really, I was in that type of environment until I managed to persuade both my parents. My father has not been able to play as active role in my life and our upbringing as much as he'd like to. But I managed to persuade him and my mother to support me in going to a Quaker boarding school for 3 years. And that was the only time I was educated outside of the state system, and that was for the O levels.
Mm. But there does seem to be a pattern when you read about or talk to people who've made a big success of their lives. That there does seem to be a very early onset of responsibility and a very early acquaintanceship with the realities of life. And you just described. I mean, it's almost textbook what you just said.
Yeah.
You clearly have a highly developed sense of what things cost.
Absolutely.
Would that be right?
Absolutely. Well, you're confronted, as you say, with reality. I do remember sometime nights when my mother will cry, you know, because she's worried about not being able to, you know, get enough money in for food. This was certainly during her teacher training and having to go out to work on the weekends when she didn't want to work. Because she wanted to be with us, and us left with neighbours. So, you know, you get pretty acquainted with life at the sharp edge. And I think, you know, you make your decision then, really, about what you want to do. And certainly with the inspirational leadership of someone like, you know, my mother at that young age, who is a worker, full stop, end of story, you know, that's inset and ingrained in your mindset from the very early days.
And the idea that education and work go hand in hand rather than being separate worlds.
Absolutely, hand in hand. And it was always books, always all around the place, which I'm eternally grateful for. You know, you go into some kids' houses nowadays and, you know, you don't see any books, you just see TV games and video consoles and so on and so forth. So always had an appetite for learning, and was always encouraged at all points in time to just learn, read, you know, this is your way out, education. And for some reason, I remember just always having, I knew that I had to and wanted to become rich. I didn't know how, no idea how, and none of my family, if it all up my mother's line, if you look up what they all were. They were sort of grammar school teachers, and they were farmers and craftsmen and so on and so forth. And so there's no predisposition for...
No big businessmen or entrepreneurs or anything like that?
No, well, except on her parental grandfather's side, the founder of the Cambridge Evening News. So her great-great-grandfather was an entrepreneur.
And an intellectual as well, by the sound of it.
Well, you know,
no?
Learned.
Yes.
You know, I wouldn't necessarily say an intellectual, but
well,
just
a practical yeah. thinking man.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So maybe I've got something of him in me, you know, four or five generations separate us. No, otherwise they've been just regular, you know, middle class people. But obviously when you get divorced at a very young age, you're in a different environment there, and that's the environment I was brought up in. I'll tell you one lasting impression I do have, though, that probably motivated me. We're on free school dinners, and when you're on free school dinners, that's the, you know, you're at the low end of the low.
Look down on.
Yeah, you're at the low end of the low, and I do remember, for some reason, they always used to queue up for lunch. This is at Chiswick Comprehensive School. And then the dinner lady will come out and say, hey, all the free school dinner people, come forward now. And you'd all sort of, you know, troop up to the front of the line, you know, because they wanted to whack you all through.
This sounds like the moment when you really wanted to be rich.
Yeah, then I thought, no, this is...
And if you ever have any children,
you weren't
going to put them through this.
No, that's right, and there's no need to put people through that, because everyone is sensitive to certain degrees. Now, one big criticism against me is I'm not sensitive enough, but, you know, that was enough for me to hang my head in shame as everyone looked at you, and you get little snipes in the queue and little jokes that you're poor, and, you know, you just don't...
But, I mean, you don't get a place like the one I've just been walking around in, talking with people, with a good atmosphere like that, without having some sense of other people's attitudes and feelings.
That's right, yeah.
It certainly seemed like a nice workplace.
Mm. Well, people work better when they're happy. I mean, there should be no surprises in that.
We're getting ahead.
Yeah.
You went to LSE, right? London School of Economics.
Yes.
How did that work out? How did you manage to do it?
Well, the Quaker School, I knew, let's step back. When I went to Chiswick Comprehensive in the first 2 years, I won some prizes for achievement, and I looked at myself and I thought, good God, man, you know, you're going down the drain here at this school, because it was definitely suited to the lowest common denominator.
And
the
you
class
don't have to go down the drain. Is
yeah.
The prizes told you that, didn't they?
Yeah, and I don't have to go down the drain. And sadly, I mean, I was in maybe the top three or four boys who came out of our primary school, and they went to the same school as me, and they deteriorated rapidly, you know, in years one and years two. And I could see myself ending up, you know, going the wrong way with all the trouble associated with that if I'd stayed around in that school environment. So I then went to... You know, that's when I made my appeal to other members of the family to try and, you know, help get me out of here. And the Quakers, that was a school, a boarding school, where my grandfather used to live in the same area, Saffron Walden, and he was a grammar school master in that area. And he recommended it for children. He said, you know, being from an inner London background and being fairly hard to the world as you are. The Quakers would be a very good environment for me
to learn
in.
And of course, their business traditions are world-shaping, aren't they? I mean,
well, business and philanthropic, and a great liberal, classical liberal, I'm afraid we have to say today, to distinguish it from, you know, how the words become corrupted as we've gone on. But a great classical liberal tradition, and really, their method of education. Untold admiration for them, the patience that they have, and the, you know, encouragement for you to inquire and to talk about you know, matters that affect society, just hit the right button for me fairly early on, 13, 14 years old. So I was given a very broad, sweeping education there, and they're tremendous people. As you know, they're pacifists. They're unilateral pacifists as well.
Yes.
So they're idealists in that respect. I respect them. I'm not a Quaker myself, but I certainly respect their ideal of peace. I don't think anyone can.
The word peace is across the top of your website at the Cobden Centre.
That's right.
Some of the pages.
Yes, because one of Cobden's themes was arbitration, not war. And the more you trade with people, the more Abdullah trades with Hans, who trades with John. And the more you've got at risk in each other's countries, the less likely you are to go to war. So you know that's chimed with me from a very, very early age. They're idealists. They're going for their ideal. I wouldn't personally go for unilateral peace and be a pacifist and be a Quaker, because the human condition I don't think is ready for that yet. But there's no reason why we can't idealise those ideals and
certainly aim for
and it. Aim for it.
Yes.
Yeah. So they fostered that great kind of debating
practical idealism.
Yeah, practical idealism in me. I then, for once, we couldn't afford to stay there, so I went to Hammersmith West London College, which was a baptism of fire into an inner London hardcore Socialist Worker Party run college, and I started up the Federation of Conservative Students branch there. Which was my sort of first act of defiance to the college authorities. And I think I had two members.
Congratulations.
Yes.
People are often very apologetic about how few people they have in their groups, but in my experience, the difference between two and zero is all the difference.
Yes, all the difference, yeah. But that was...
Even if it's only in terms of enabling you to develop your own thinking better.
Yes, and it helped develop the own thinking, because then, I suppose, I got introduced to the thinking of Hayek.
So this was before you got
before LSE.
Yeah.
Yeah, before LSE. So there's murmurings in various FCS literature about Hayek. There's the great alternative bookshop, which I know you were involved with certainly down many years ago.
Early 1980s to mid-1980s.
That's right. So to put a time frame on this, this must have been 86 for me now, 86 to 88. And I just remember my first Hayek book purchase, there's an interesting story here, was when I was sitting, I'd organised, I think it was the then Secretary of State, Home Secretary Douglas Hurd, to go and speak to the Hammersmith Conservatives. I'd helped organise that, and it was at the Polish Centre in Hammersmith. And I was just speaking to one of the old boys there, who was clearly a soldier, had been a soldier during the war, and there a lot of Polish community had settled in Hammersmith. They must have been anti-communist, presumably, for not being in Poland. And he said, yes, you'd be very interested in this gentleman called Hayek, yeah? And he showed me into their bookshop, and there was Eamon Butler's first quick little introduction to Hayek, which is now available online. So that was the first Hayek book I read, age 16, maybe 17, A General Introduction, and I was hooked there, really. Because, interesting, Eamon Butler didn't do anything really to do with Hayek's economics, which of course, as I later found out, was what he was won his Nobel Prize for. But it was all 1945 onwards, Road to Serfdom onwards, and that was very easy to get into that way of thinking. So that's what sparked off a definite interest in social and political science, and the kingpin place to go to is LSE.
Yes.
So I applied to
which is where Hayek himself.
Yes,
fought, isn't it?
From 31 to 50. I believe he was there. So I get myself into the LSE in 88, into the economics department, and I lasted there for the full year in the economics department. I couldn't do any more, because their economics at that stage of teaching was very simple Keynesian and very simple monetarist outlooks that you would learn.
Perfect competition.
Yes, all the usual stylized, highly stylized textbook stuff that can exist in an abstract where there's no human beings participating, but can't exist in the real world.
So there's no confusion or ignorance in that world, is there?
Yes, it's very problematic for me.
Also, everybody does the same things.
Yes,
silly.
Yes, the so-called rational economic agent. But anyway, it was all a bit Alice in Wonderland for me, and the really defining Alice in Wonderland moment. I could get along with, You know, that was all fine. And then there's this huge disconnect. It's almost as if you're studying biology one moment and then you're studying English literature the next moment. That's how big the disconnect is between macro and micro. So getting into macro, I just remember being shown the multiplier on the wall by the lecturer, you know, where the pound goes in, and you know, there's a concertina line going ka-ching, 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 and you know, £10 comes out the other end, and you just think, wow. I honestly thought for about 30 seconds, this is it, this is the cure to world poverty, just spend money, yeah, this is it. Yeah. And then suddenly reality then dawned about 30 seconds later. No, this is mad, Toby, it's mad, yeah?
Well, at the very least, yeah, the pound has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, where's it?
And there's some other zigzags going on where the pound was taken from.
That's right, and, yeah, so exactly. That's the great man who exposes that Bastiat with a broken window fallacy. Anyway, I sort of paused at that point in time, and then when I was choosing my second year options, I got out of the economics department and headed firmly for what we in the LSE, the only people in the world, call the government department, but commonly known as the politics department, and studied political philosophy and law. And then I was exposed to...
And of course Hayek has lots to say about law as well, doesn't he?
Yes, yes.
So that would predispose you to being interested, and you'd bring a certain point of view to the study of law.
Yes.
Not necessarily shared by the teachers or the other students.
The teachers, under Dr. Orr, I was under Dr. Orr, he was an Oakeshottian.
Then he would understand.
Yeah, so he would understand. We got a great, and I got the great sort of Oakeshott, he was one of Oakeshott's key men, so I almost felt like I was being taught by Oakeshott himself for political philosophy, which is fantastic. Yeah. And with that exposure into law. But just the only thing of Hayek ever taught in the LSE is 1945 onwards, i.e. none of his economics, despite the fact that he was there, you know, for the best part of 20-21 years as a mainstream professor there, and he won his work on the Nobel Prize for the work he did at the LSE, the prices and production lectures and so on.
So by now you would have been reading lots of Austrian economics, von Mises.
Not the economics.
Ah, right.
Yeah, just the political science,
yes,
and the political philosophy. That's all I was exposed to. But I was very conscious that I keep on hearing about, you know, this man Hayek and how great an economist he was, and then never ever seeing any of his economic works, never being able to buy any, never being able to find
any. So when did you acquaint yourself with Austrian school economics?
Well, that was really from about 95, 96 onwards, because I made a mental note to myself when I left LSE, right, at some point in time in life, I'm going to actually do the job properly. Yeah, and learn fully about the economics side of the whole Austrian school, because you know the modern social and political science side of the Austrian school, that's easy to get, you know, hold of information. You know, at your alternative bookshop, there's always the Constitution of Liberty, law, legislation,
the road to serfdom,
and so on and so forth, but never any of his pure theory of capital, prices and production. Monetary theory, the trade cycle, and so on and so forth. None of these were ever available or taught.
You carved out a kind of time in your life to get to grips with all.
Well, I made a mental note that, you know, when life calms down, yeah, I'll start rereading again, because I'd already started the business, you see.
Yes. Can we switch now to talking about the business? While you were at the LSE, you were paying. I read in the research before this that you paid your way through by working in a restaurant, is that right?
Yeah, no, well, I had... Sort of, right.
You owned it?
Yes, we did. I owned part of it. I owned 30% of it. But before that, the nightclub, I managed when I was 18, in my search for riches, and wealth, I used to go to the King's Road on during the summer, and, you know, there's lovely women there, and you sort of... They're all these rich heiresses walking around, and they look fantastic, and they're dripping with money, and so on and so forth. And I followed them into a nightclub, private members' nightclub called the 151 Club. And this was probably 88 now. And I just thought to myself, this is it. I've got to buy this because it's an absolute cash cow. They're queuing at the doors here, and they were charging £3 in 1987-88 for a bottle of Beck's beer. I thought, this is
this is it.
And you know, champagne bottles of vodka going out with £75. I remember watching that. I had no money, but I was starting to talk to the owner, and the owner was saying he was wanting to retire. He had just had a hernia operation. So I thought, that's it, I've got to try and buy this. How am I going to buy it? I've no idea. Don't have any money. This is a big problem. Don't have any money. So go and ask some people who've got some money. And by that time, I was involved in Tory politics, as I think I've mentioned.
Yeah.
So I selected some people who I thought would be appropriate, they had a bit of money behind them, and they might appreciate the nightclub because they, you know, might appreciate that new exposure to females, shall we say. And I suggested this to them, and they're very interested. So I got, I think, 5% for doing the deal of sweat equity, and then I managed to get up to 22% by the time 91. By 1991.
Well, you gradually bought.
Yeah, but just buying a little bit more, and getting given bits for increasing membership and so on and so forth. And that paid me through. That paid me through university. And I didn't want to take the grant. I think I took the grant for the first year, but the second year and the third year, I know I definitely did not take the grant, because I thought, if you can afford to fund yourself, then don't touch the money. You know, it's someone else's money, isn't it? It's come all off the taxpayer, and I know how hard it is to earn money, you know, out there in the free world, and then to have it expropriated is you know, one of the nastiest things you can do. So, you know, my small little bit, I could reduce the burden on the taxpayer. So I funded myself, and that was very good. But you know, you can't do realistically. LSE is a proper pucker establishment, and you know, every single one of the texts in political philosophy you're meant to read in full. So you know, you imagine starting off with Plato and Aristotle, and working all your way up to the modern thinkers. You know, I couldn't do a proper job there, because I'm running my business on the one hand, and I'm you know, scraping by, doing whatever I needed to do to make sure I still stayed in LSE, because I wanted that piece of paper, you know, at the end to say, there's my degree, I'm qualified, it's a pucker place, you know, that's the third party acknowledgement in the outside world. So I just did enough to stay in there, rather, you know, shamelessly. I'd never advise it clearly for any other person to throw caution to the wind there, but that's what I did. But I mean, I just love the stuff, and I could quite happily have another life just learning. But that's what made me think, well, certainly I'll just go back to learning as soon as I could ever find, you know, any time. But the nightclub, I thought, 91, you know, it's the tail. It was what I thought was the depths of the recession, but really the recession was only going to, it went really bad from 91 to 93. So I got myself out of the nightclub and then into the restaurant.
Was
6 weeks before I graduated. I got the restaurant, and that was a third share with two other businessmen. And that I thought instead of doing the graduate milk round, I mean, I did pay lip service to the graduate milk round, and I thought, well, I'm sort of in foodie, winey, entertainment things. I went to Trust House Forte, and they offered me a job on their graduate recruitment program. But when I remember being interviewed at the Little Chef somewhere down the M3, somewhere, I can't remember the exact location. But the guy said, "Yep, you'll be great for the graduate recruitment program. You'll be running a place like this, and let me show you your uniform." And I had one of those moments when I looked at that Little Chef uniform and I thought, no.
Back in the queue for the poor boys.
Yeah, I'm never ever in a million years going to step in that uniform. I'm just not going to do it. And then I realised at that point in time, no, Toby, you are not suitable. You're not suitable for paid employment. So, you know, there you go. You're on your own. And the restaurant.
So the restaurant became the focus of your business activity. And your job, as I understand it, was obtaining the food, and particularly the meat. Is that right?
No. Well, that's what it became in the end, because running the restaurant, the Gulf War had started, and the Gulf War was particularly a turning point, a bit like the Lehman's, a bit like Lehman's Brothers in this recession. As soon as that went, the economy fell off the edge of the cliff. The Gulf War was not as extreme in terms of the falling off the edge of the cliff effect, but it certainly had big implications for the slowing down of the economy. And to try and keep the restaurant afloat, that's when I started going to the markets. And I would go to the three markets in London.
Basically to cut the cost of
cut
the food.
Cut the costs, yeah. And I was saving £1,000 a week doing it. And that was sufficient enough just to keep the thing afloat. But all the time I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, if I'm saving £1,000 a week, I can be earning £1,000 a week going the other way.
And this is how you got into the food distribution business, because you were doing something exceptional in terms of the prices of the food, but the restaurant itself was not so remarkable. I mean, it was just a restaurant.
No. Yeah, it was...
Why not specialise in what you really are?
Yes, well, I specialised in the supply, because that's where the money was, clearly. And we sold the restaurant for a loss. It was not sold as an ongoing concern, but for a loss of... I think we each had £70,000 loss. So, you know, I think I was 21 years old. I might have been 20 or 21. So at that point in time, you know, I had that fateful meeting with the bank manager, where the bank manager says, well, Mr. Baxendale, how are you going to pay this loss? And I says, I don't know, sir. You know, I haven't got any money. Because by that time, you can imagine a kid with money. Because as much as I thought I was an adult, I was a kid. Yeah. Mm. And it was a pound in and a pound and 5p out. So my meeting with the bank manager was a very, you know, sort of, well, it was a dangerous moment for me. And
I imagine Little Chef might have loomed large in his thinking.
Yes, he would have preferred to see me in nice, simple, paid employment, pay your money back.
With a uniform.
Yeah.
Yes.
But
regular checks coming in.
Yeah. In fairness to him, though, I said to him, look, I'm doing the supply for the restaurant. And by that time, I'd already knocked on the doors of two other restaurateurs, so I had the rubrics of the business started. And I said to the bank manager, I will not employ a driver, I'll still do the buying and the preparation, and I'll do the deliveries myself and the collection of the money and so on and so forth, and the wages that I have provisioned for that driver can go to a loan repayment. And that was, I think, £10,000 a year. So I got a loan account set up for I think it was 8 or 9 years, but I paid it off in 15 months.
Because effectively you found yourself running a business.
Yeah. And I paid the bank manager off.
Sorry, I don't make it sound like it just happened. You made it happen.
Yeah. 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 And then have been motoring on since.
And to bring us up to date with the business, I mean, your colleague was showing me round. It's quite a big thing,
yeah,
isn't it? I mean, you've got branches all over, all the big seaports of the UK. Mm. You've got your connections.
Yes, is that?
And you're selling food in not just in London, but all over the UK.
Yes, we supply the whole nation. Anywhere across the nation, we can supply.
And you get your fish and other produce from all over the world.
Yes,
for aeroplanes coming in, all that sort of thing.
That's right. For all the UK species, obviously from the UK ports. The North Atlantic is very important to us, Iceland, Norway, Greenland, for really cold water fish. And we do a lot in the Indian Ocean with tropical fish that are in demand here. But we're the largest fresh fish wholesaler to the food service sector. And I distinguish that from the retail sector, i.e. supplying supermarkets.
Yes, your typical customer would be something like a big hotel in London or Edinburgh or somewhere like that.
Yes, a hotel.
Or a very good restaurant.
Contract catering, so any of the corporate venues, banks, lawyers, football stadium.
All the sort of people who want to serve really nice food but don't want to have to get up at 4 a.m. to go to Billingsgate to worry about the cost of fish.
That kind of thing. And we turn over 100 million turnover. We've always grown, even grown through the recession.
What do you say, all businesses, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I get the feeling a lot of businesses, there's something special, some quite in retrospect, quite simple thing that you did that the other people didn't do. Is there anything like that for you?
Yes, I would concur with that. I think simplicity is the beauty, and it's just going in there with a fresh mind. Because remember, I didn't come from, you know, X generations of fishmongers or X generations of butchers or greengrocers. So really, when you're listening to your customers, you want to satisfy their needs. So you listen to what they want, and then do your best to satisfy them, and that's the be all and end.
Whereas your old school fishmongers tended to be a little bit prima donna-ish compared to you. Would
yes.
that be a fair?
Yes, a fair thing to say. And we've only done it this way, therefore we'll only do it that way, and this is how we do it. And
you, on the other hand, are saying, right, that's what you want, that's what you get.
Well, the truth is, I had no idea how I should do it. So
the customers told you.
The customers told me. Yeah. So they I think they thought, oh, breath of fresh air. This man wants to be led by us. But I think that's always a wise thing, is you take your heed from your customer, and then you work your way backwards to
build the business around.
Yeah, around the customer.
Mm. And that's how many people do you have working for you now?
I think we'd be 550 around.
You've got past the stage where you know exactly.
Yes, well, you don't. you can't know after the 30 or 40 people in reality. But we run it entirely on an entrepreneurial basis. So every single depot has its own P&L.
What's that?
Profit and loss account.
Yes.
We incentivize literally every division in that P&L on a performance related basis. So I like to think I've got many little owners, although I'm the principal owner.
It reminds me of what you said 20 minutes ago, whatever it was, about you didn't want to just be an employee.
No.
And you kind of feel that's how people are going to feel about it themselves.
Yes, they've got to feel that they're not just turning up, like I would feel if I was just turning up at that little chef and sticking my uniform on. Now, with a certain type of person, you're never ever going to be able to get them, incentivized on a profit incentive. Sometimes their aspirations are that is all they want to do, and that's fine, and there's a big role for that type of person in life. But for quite a lot of people, if you get them on a performance related, they become little entrepreneurs themselves within your business.
And they start suggesting new ways of doing things.
Yes, because it's absolutely impossible for me as one person to manage this business.
Spoken like an Austrian. Yeah. Dispersed knowledge.
Dispersed knowledge, yes. Exactly. And it is Austrianism applied to business, and it makes perfect sense. And the greatest person who follows this line of thinking is Charles Koch in America, where he has the largest private company.
That would be K-O-C-H, is it?
Yeah, so he pronounces it Coke himself, right. But Koch to if you write it. $90 billion of revenues, and he's a private company, and I think they claim that a third of all things you ever touch that's made by man have got something to do with him. But he breaks his businesses, all his businesses up to the minimal sort of management unit, five or six people, and they're all highly incentivized on their own little P&Ls, and no.
So in other words, if you're not too greedy, if you're willing to share profits with eager and hardworking collaborators, you will end up doing much more.
I think
profit
so.
Making
yeah.
yourself.
I think so.
Do I detect a distinct non-ending of your ambition to get rich? I mean, this is not the end of the line as far as you're concerned. This is just you've got. What plans do you have for the future? Or do you prefer not to talk about
that? The get rich thing was don't be poor.
Yes. Yeah?
That was the principle.
So that's mission accomplished as far as that's concerned.
Mission accomplished. Now, I do get intellectual stimulation about doing business, but after a while, you know, you think to yourself, I'm not going to just do it for the purpose of putting more zeros on my my personal balance sheet. That doesn't give me any greater satisfaction. So I'm at the point whereby yes, we'll keep on going because we will always pursue excellence, But
this leads us directly then to the Cobden Centre.
Yes, yeah, so
because you know it's as if your life is taking a different turn now. You've got the business working.
Yes.
And you're now applying the insights that you've learned both as a businessman and as a reader and a studier of these things to the wider world.
That's right.
I must say the thing that you said that most impressed me was the bit about not accepting a grant. I mean, it's clear that you've had in mind to do more than business.
Yes.
I mean, that's not a typical thing that your average tradesman would say, I would suggest.
Maybe not. I'm a magistrate. I do my bit for the community, or I feel, you know, maybe it's my sort of hair shirt approach to life. I feel I do my day or day and a half a month.
Again, Quaker.
Yeah, to the community. But I will not fill out an expense form for lunch and for the driving to and from or for the car parking, because fundamentally, yeah, I can deal with that myself. I don't need or want anything from the taxpayer. It's a privilege to serve my community by participating in the criminal justice system.
Yeah. Would I be correct in thinking that you've been encouraged by free market writings to regard the life of an entrepreneur as a very moral one?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a thoroughly moral, a moral lifestyle.
Because a lot of businessmen are rather apologetic, maybe just because they just expect to be sneered at by whoever they're talking to.
Mm.
And actually, in themselves, they do feel morally correct in what they're doing.
Mm.
But they often are rather reluctant to.
Well, we've let the
even to think like that, I suspect.
That's right. We collectively as businessmen have let the agenda be taken away from us, and we're on the back foot. I'm personally not on the back foot. I'm on the front foot. I think doing entrepreneurial activity and creating wealth for the wealth for society is a very rare and a privileged thing to do. I have the capability to do that. I'm in a unique pool of a small people who are capable of doing that. That's the foundation of the whole of society. I don't care what anyone else says. If we do not generate wealth, nothing else happens in society. Nothing. So you can talk about
There are no magic multipliers.
No magic.
Somebody has to multiply.
Yeah, no magic multipliers. You can't talk about NHS. You can't talk about teaching. You can't talk about anything in life without the wealth creators creating the wealth in the first place. So I view myself right at the very front end, you know, of doing good and benefiting society. And entrepreneurs should be
proud.
Yeah, proud, absolutely, and not afraid to say that I'm a businessman. I'm creating wealth, because all the spin-offs, the great spin-offs that it has. And I think the reason why, obviously, like in the police force, you will always have, or every 100 officers, you'll have one bent officer. In every 100 businessmen, you'll have one bent businessman. They're more high profile because the amount of lives and destruction that they can cause by being corrupt, like Bernie Madoff.
Yes.
I would incidentally say, by the way, his Ponzi scheme that Bernie Madoff ran is dwarfed, absolutely dwarfed, by this state-run Ponzi scheme called our pension fund and all our social security benefits.
I read this. Which is some of your writings for the Cobden Centre. Yeah. Can we talk about that?
Mm.
Who's? I mean, you and it's a group of people, isn't it?
I set it up.
Right.
My inspiration initially. I don't have the time yet to put into it on a full-time basis. But the reason why I've chosen Richard Cobden is because of the Great Manchester School that he contributed to and was one of the key founders of, Manchester School Liberalism. That chimes with me very, very well.
Free trade, peace.
Free trade, peace. Unilateral free trade, actually, which I think is.
So it's very important that a lot of people seem to think you can only do free trade if the other people agree to it. But
absolutely, you can just unilaterally do
it. Well, Hong Kong just did it.
Didn't
ask anyone's permission in mainland China.
And Hong Kong, despite the fact that it's notionally quote unquote communist, is still one of the great champions of the free world.
So
the corn laws, though, this is the other big theme. The Cop of the Night liberals realised very quickly in the game that the privilege that the aristocrats had got themselves to be able to price their produce over and above market clearing levels was detrimental to the masses of the people, whose largely their income was to buy food. So the masses of the population are being price gouged because of the legal privilege granted to the aristocrats. And the Corn Law was the first proper real stab at privilege, legal privilege, where one class of person can exploit another class of person.
Very much the way you now write about what bankers are doing to regular people.
Yes, absolutely.
Same sort of thing.
Absolutely. And it's not, it's bankers, you can say it's when trade unionists get a closed shop and they can then exploit their company and their customers at the expense, you know, at the expense of, yeah, of those classes of people. Anywhere where one class is being favoured by legal privilege over and above another class, the Manchester Liberals were hot on the case. The Corn Laws being the most obvious thing that they managed to get abolished, and they're true heroes in the liberal social reform movement of mine. All the great Manchester Liberals, Cobden, I particular favour for, because, you know, they were all business people, but Cobden was in the vanguard of that Corn Law reform and the fight against entrenched privilege, which is a huge market distortion, as we all know, is grossly unfair. So free trade, the Corn Law movement, and international peace and arbitration. And the modern Corn Law equivalent, I would say, interestingly, following Hayek, and if you read the last page of his Denationalisation of Money, he calls for a modern free money movement, because the legal control of the money supply, money is a commodity after all, by a class of persons, the government, with their private sector allies, the bankers, because they're all, one can't live without the other. They effectively are allowed to do dishonest things, and which means
it's almost impossible for them to avoid it, actually, isn't it? It almost becomes like that.
The whole system is
because if they don't, then everybody else in their business sneers at them for not taking the profits that are there.
That's right.
So it's a very corrupting environment.
It's a corrupting environment, and having state control of the money supply and then private sector bankers being able to overissue their initial money bases by being able to fractionally reserve and lend out on these huge multiples of leverage is massively distorting for the
and of course being sort of capitalists, they're very, very efficient at being corrupt, as
yes,
it were.
Yes, they are.
It only makes it worse.
But what you need? Well, they're not corrupt in law, because what they're doing is completely and utterly lawful. But I would say you need to get government being honest. A government being honest is when it can go to the people and say, I've got A, B, and C social policies that I want to do. Yeah, and I need X, Y, and Z worth of your tax money to be able to do that. Election? Do you want us to do that? Yes or no? And instead, we have government goes out and says, I want to do X, Y, and Z, you know, policy to favour A, B, and C in interest groups, and it doesn't tell you how it's going to pay for it, because invariably it only does a little bit from taxation, and then it will do a large scale. Well, we've seen it with quantitative easing, we see it with other words that they use, open market transactions. Or just buying the debt office, buying and selling bonds is always an increase in the money supply. And when that money supply is increased, and this is the most poisonous thing that happens, is if we increase the money supply and say buy a bond, £1 billion bond, off a hedge fund who holds that bond, he gets the immediate wealth benefit of that new money. That hedge fund does. Yeah. So when he goes out and spends on his boat and he spends on his house and he spends on all the rich trappings of life, which is fine, He's perfectly entitled to do that, and there are wealth benefiting effects that spin out from that expenditure. But he gets the initial benefit of those lower prices before his spending starts pushing up other prices in the economy. And the people on fixed income, the pensioners, the unemployed people, they're the last people to receive this so-called wealth benefit effect, and they will pay higher prices for everything. So all we succeed in doing is a wealth transfer.
So it's the ultimate stealth tax.
Well, it's not only the ultimate stealth tax, it's a wealth transfer from the poorest members of society to the richest members of society. And that's how it always works. Yeah, and that's the thing that really gets my goat up, as I'm sure our predecessors, you know, 150 yeah. years ago in the Manchester reform movements, that disturbed them considerably with the food arrangements. Yeah. But the modern movement is that what I call the honest money movement.
So, and the Cobden Centre, one of the things I see you trying to do is to get these ideas discussed in the wider
in the wider context
chat.
But you see, for me to be able to do that, I've had the initial idea. If you like, I'm the sort of entrepreneur with the initial idea. Steve Baker, who is now the Tory Party candidate for Wickham, has been instrumental, absolutely instrumental in getting this up and running. And Tim Evans has joined us as a full-time CEO. He was at LSE two years above me when he was doing his doctorate. So we've stayed in touch over the years, and he is a great fundraiser. And we will build this what I call a social reform movement. I'm very careful about not calling us a think tank, which a lot of people are trying to call us. We're not a think tank. We're a social reform movement.
It would be fair to say that sort of the thinking has been done, and you're trying to get it out there now.
Yes.
Would that be right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's no. I wouldn't claim any original, great big earth-shattering ideas for myself. A lot of these are.
So publicising ideas rather than researching any shatteringly new ones.
Yes.
Is the agenda?
Yes. Although, I mean, I think.
I mean, if a good new idea comes along, you don't turn it away. But
no.
But.
I think I've made some genuine intellectual contributions for how to define money and the money supply.
Yes.
That are up there on the website. Mm-hmm. But
there'll be links. Any blog postings associated with this conversation will have links to for people to follow up. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. But we're also a social reform movement. A gentleman called Chris Neal has come into my life, who's chairman of the Jobs Clubs. And we are going to be actively going into the underbelly, if you like, or of society, or the areas that are completely forgotten, where no banks go, where there can't be bankable deals, because people either, you know, haven't got the right utility bills or the right, you know, fixed address, and so on and so forth, and going into those communities and lending microfinance style loans to these people to get their little enterprises established, because, you know, the welfare state and the Job Centre Plus and so on and so forth, I don't think they may be very well intentioned people and good people. I don't think they're ever going to be able to address those problems. So we're aiming to go out and develop the whole job club side of things.
Wow.
As one of our social reform programs.
Well, it's been fascinating talking with you, Toby. It could go on a lot longer. In general, you seem to be a man who, despite having had quite a tough life, is nevertheless grateful for it.
I mean, eternally.
And proud of the life you've lived, and yes. By all accounts, you're entitled to be, and you're trying to spread a bit of that around. And
yep.
Good.
Well, I think everyone deserves it, and for people like me who can see the iniquitous practices.
You sort of, I mean, the meeting somebody like you makes me think of that old crack about I didn't have his disadvantages. You know, in a sense, you had exactly the right combination of problems and answers.
Mm.
And clearly, there's lots of people in the world with the problems, and if you can help them with some of the answers, from a point of view that where you can say I've been there, I know what you're going through.
No,
it's really helpful.
It's a pleasure, and in our society. Here in the UK, we've got great examples of people who've done that. You mentioned about the Quakers, the Roundtrees, the Cadburys, the Barclays, bank people. I mean, there's a whole great history in this country of businessmen.
Quakers didn't make a point of spending a lot of money on their own fripperies, did they?
No.
Are you a bit like that? Is your home a pretty kind of basic kind of place?
Or? No, it's not. I do have a rather grand place, but we don't have, you know.
I was greatly impressed by the fact that this business is. It doesn't have a grand front door and a posh reception area.
Well, we have no. There's no head office here as well. There's none of the trappings of wealth. You
anyway. Look, I've got to stop this. I could go on and on, chattering with you. It's been a great pleasure, but
time permits.
We must stop. Thank you very, very much, Toby Baxendale.